What connections might we see between creation and the gospel? Hello, this is Good Word. I'm Dave Thomas, your continuing moderator for these series of lessons in which we've been looking at creation, particularly the creation account in the book of Genesis, and then also exploring some of the implications that accrue to Christian living as a result of the creation. And today in this lesson, we're going to look at possible connections between creation and the gospel. My conversation partners, whom I've been enjoying dialogue with, are Bob Cushman, a scientist, and Alden Thompson, a biblical studies expert. Gentlemen, perhaps there are some connections between creation and the gospel, although they would not be obvious at the point of creation, because when God made the planet according to the book of Genesis, it was all good, and so there was nothing to save. The question comes then, what happens after the story in Genesis 3, where sin invades not only the world, but apparently has cosmic effect, because we learn from Revelation that sin even produced war in heaven. And it seems that if we're going to understand any possible connections between creation and the gospel, we first have to understand the effects of sin and the plight that we were left in. And maybe I'll start the discussion by referring to Ephesians, the second chapter. There's some very interesting verses there where the Apostle Paul talks about what theologians refer to as the plight of humanity. What are the conditions in which people found themselves subsequent to the fall? And he talks about several things. First of all, that we are dead spiritually. And then he talks about being enslaved by the devil, the world, and our own human natures. And those three things have fascinated me in strange kind of way, because the devil, we all know about, he's a deceiver and he deceives people. We often like to pick at Eve for being deceived, but we fall to prey to her kind of temptations all the time. It talks about the world, which Paul, I think, means by that the whole of societal construct without God, and we are left to consider all the fads and fancies that come marching through human experience that seem to be irresistible to so many. And then our own human natures. And here is one of the most amazing things, that even those systems which sustain our lives, whether it be the desire to eat or to sleep or to engage in wholesome activity or to exercise the mind or to experience affection, that even those things unbridled can enslave us. And if you've ever tried to help somebody change a habit, you know full well how deeply ingrained that can be. And then, as if all of that is not bad, that we're spiritually dead, enslaved by the devil, the world, and our own human natures, in addition to that, he says, we're condemned by birth. And so when you think about the plight of human beings, that's the result of the fall, we are looking at a serious problem that, biblically speaking, can only be resolved by some kind of good news.
Now, I'd be interested in your definition of gospel, because I think there's another one lurking in the Old Testament, which is not necessarily the one when we use the phrase law, gospel.
Well, don't make me describe myself. Just out with your answer.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking here of Deuteronomy chapter 4, where Moses is just popping his buttons about law. And he says even the nations will say, wow, what great nation has such a great God as we have, who's actually told us how to live? See? And it seems to me that we bridge the gap much more readily if we can say that God's counsel is to us, in any event, good news. You could actually use the phrase law as gospel.
Although certainly from the New Testament, salvation is by grace through faith, not by adherence to a law. So how does that fit?
If you look at the original intention of law, it's not simply a matter of condemnation.
Yeah.
It is it's a gift of life. See.
In other words, if you adhere to this law appropriately with the right spirit, it will direct you in ways that will save you.
question of salvation doesn't even come up in that question. I think of the New Covenant promise, no longer shall they teach one another or say to each other, know the Lord, for they shall all know me from the least of them to the greatest, for I will forgive their sins and remember their iniquity no more.
And write the law on hearts of flesh instead of hearts of stone.
Yeah, yeah. And so in an ideal world, nobody has to worry about broken laws, see? And my hope for the creation is a new creation where nobody but nobody's going to tell me what to do. Now, you know, Dave, that I've got a bit of acid in my system. I don't like to be told what to do. And in that sense, creation, the gospel, we look forward to a new world, a recreated world. That is a great blessing to us.
You remind me that I attended a boarding school as a young man where the principal had a new principal, and he announced on the first day that there were no rules because we hadn't misbehaved, that he would make rules as we misbehave. Well, of course, there are hidden rules in that case, but he quantified some of them as we went along, so I was intrigued by that statement.
I think some of our course syllabi end up being that way as for classes. As we have experiences with students, we start putting things in there to address certain situations that come up, and every so often you've got to go clean that syllabus up because it ends up being bits and pieces of those.
Or add something because a certain practice has invaded the classroom, like right. texting or something like that. I'm intrigued how in the beginning there's no need for salvation, and then...
And apparently no need for explicit law.
Yes, no need for explicit law. But after the emergence of sin and the plight of humanity results in the need for redemption, I'm intrigued by the fact that God begins to act redemptively immediately. Mm-hmm. So often I find as a human being when somebody does something that I find deleterious or wrong, I'm not inclined to step up to them and say, well, look, let me act in a gracious way and in a redemptive way. My tendency is to step back and say, well, I'm going to wait until you get what's coming, and then we'll talk about saving your hide later. But I wonder if we could reflect for a few minutes on what God did that was gracious immediately. As soon as sin appears, what does God do that shows his graciousness? Any thoughts come to mind?
Well, he makes clothes for them.
Yes. But I've also thought it begins before that, where he still comes to see them. He doesn't just leave them hidden. He actually mm-hmm. still comes to meet his daily appointment.
And, he comes looking for them.
Yes. And he speaks kindly to them, although, I don't think the voice was angry, but it was chastening, if I can put it that way.
Well, the problem is if you have a sinner, Ellen White uses the comment, the sinner's thoughts are his own accusers.
Yes. Or the wicked flee where no man pursues.
That's right.
Yeah.
When I was a young pastor, I had a young mother. She was 22, single, had four preschool boys. Mm. And the town we were in, drugs were readily available. And she says, just two contacts like that, and I could have drugs again. And she made the comment to me. She says, Pastor, you are to me like a guilty conscience. if she begins to slip and I show up on her porch, oh no.
See? Yeah.
So, and if you don't do that, if you just let them fry, again, Ellen White uses the phrase, a cruel kindness.
Yeah.
We'll just leave them to themselves.
Yeah.
Let them play in the streets. So, what if they get run over?
They'll learn on their own account if they survive.
Yeah.
And see, that's precisely, God did not extend a cruel kindness. He got involved.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the whole establishment of the sacrificial message and the sacrificial system. And I like to project from there all the way through the Bible, and you think of all those incidents in the Bible which indicate a continuing of God's redemptive message for his creation that has been lost. Not the least of which, and perhaps one of the most fascinating, is that comment, I think, in Romans, where Paul says that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly.
And Three times he says that, while we were yet enemies.
Yeah.
While we were yet sinners. While we were opposed to him.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Yeah. But I mean, when you think about that, wow, that represents a degree of graciousness that is not often seen in human experience, in history, let alone in individual human experience. And I mean, I think John talks about that people may be willing to die for somebody else, but how many of us would die for enemies? See?
I think it speaks, you know, as I respond to that phrase, I think it speaks to God's pursuit of us for salvation rather than waiting for us to come to Him.
That yeah.
While we may not always be readily responsive to Him, He's still in pursuit of us.
And I like the observation made. I mean, this kind of stuff makes very real the observation I heard that God is not in the business of keeping people out of heaven as much as He's in the business of trying to get as many people in as He can. That if there's any justification for saving you, He will do so.
And He will use all the tricks in the trade.
Now, what do you mean by that, Alden?
He will use threats, bribes, whatever. This is Paul at the end of 1 Corinthians 4. Shall I come to you with stick or with love and a spirit of gentleness?
Yeah, those seem to be the two great motivators, right?
Yep.
And some of us who don't like the stick will respond to love, and some who don't respond to love will respond to the stick.
You know, Dave, one of our majors last year made the comment. I said, in my experience, if I ask the question, you know, do you want me to come to you with stick or love? Oh, 70% will say, no stick, you know. But about 30% will say, I need the stick. Bring it on. And one of our students said, and probably about half of those who say they don't want the stick really need it.
Yeah, it's funny when you think of salvation in that. I don't want to end here today without making the observation that the redemptive plan of God involves the recreation of human person at conversion, which I think we would agree is an act, a miraculous act of creation.
If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, that projects forward to the great promise, which we will actually look at next week, our final time of dialogue, that the recreation of those portions of the cosmos which are badly damaged by sin. So the plan of redemption is linked to creation, perhaps in ways that we don't see directly until we realize the need of redemption. Any closing comments from either of you? Closing thoughts, like wow thoughts, no? Well, the grand scope of redemption is a fascinating thing that I think will occupy our attention for millennia to come in heaven, to think how it is that God could take the brokenness of life and mend it. So my thanks to you, Bob and Alden, for your participation today, and although I thanked you before, thank you for your involvement all through the quarter. My thanks to Chad Ofterhaar, our engineer, and my thanks to those of you who listen to us regularly. It's nice to hear as we go out here and there that you are listening to the Good Word. So for Good Word, I'm Dave Thomas.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.